I always think it's important to think about this. In the first seven verses of the book, the instruction is given about what this book is all about. And I want to just emphasize some things to you down here at the end, like beginning with verse 4. The purpose of this book is to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge, and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will get wise counsel. Now watch this. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. So one of the points that I've tried to emphasize to you is that part of wisdom, according to the book of Proverbs, is learning how to understand and use these proverbs. And a lot of times people don't quite realize that. I think it's important to understand that the type of literature that we're dealing with here, we are looking at wisdom literature, and that's of a different style than, say, the New Testament epistles. It's a different style than the Gospels. It's a different style than the Pentateuch. And so one of the things that Solomon says here at the very beginning is that he wants to give instruction about how to understand these proverbs and how to use them properly and understand the words of the wise and their riddles. So with that in mind, I want to just start by asking you this question. We haven't talked about this yet. We've already begun to look at several of these proverbs, but I'm going to ask you this question. Are the proverbs that we're reading in the book of Proverbs, are they always going to be true in every circumstance? Are they expressing statements that are always going to be true in every single circumstance? A lot of times people don't stop and ask that question, and I know a lot of people just sort of assume that, wisdom is wisdom. And so if there's a proverbial statement about what is true, well, then it must be always true in every single circumstance. And I'm going to challenge you with that. I think we're not being instructed about the use of these proverbs if we just treat them in a mechanical way as every one of these proverbs always making some absolute statement that is always going to be true in every single circumstance. Let me just give you some examples here, just to kind of begin our discussion of this point. Righteous lips are the delight of kings, and he who speaks right is loved. Now, what's that proverb saying? What's it teaching? If you speak what is right, if you say the truth and say righteous things, then you will be the delight of kings and you'll be loved by those in positions of authority. Isn't that what it's teaching? Okay, Dave?
You won't have any problem. You won't have a problem in his kingdom if the of his kingdom speaks right.
That's right.
And anyone who speaks right all the time is loved.
Kings love honest people. And if you're a dishonest person, you're going to incur the wrath of the king. But if you're a righteous person, it can be trusted, you speak honestly, and your word is your bond, well, then those in positions of authority over you are going to think highly of you. Isn't that obviously what that's teaching? Okay. But now let me just ask you a question. Does that mean that in every single case, there could never be a case where when you speak truth, the person who is in authority over you is maybe not going to love you? What if you have an unrighteous ruler? Maybe he doesn't like when you speak the truth. You know. Well, is that the circumstance that proverb is addressing? If you've got, let's say, a king who's a wicked king, you tell him the truth, Your Majesty, this policy you have is not going to work. You ask me my opinion, I told you righteously, it's not going to work. And, you know, he says, off with your head. Well, I mean, does that mean, what's that? Okay, all right, yeah. John the Baptist is a great example where he spoke what was true and right, but King Herod didn't love him for it. So my point is, not that proverb's wrong. That's not a wrong proverb. But you need to understand these proverbs in a wise way. And if you take them all as just some mechanical, absolute statement that is always going to be true in every single circumstance, then you're really being foolish. And you're not getting the point of this kind of literature. What these proverbs are doing are telling us things that are generally true in most circumstances. And generally, isn't it true that if you speak what is right and say honestly what is right, then you're going to be loved and respected for it? That's the point, that's the circumstance this proverb's trying to deal with. It's not trying to deal with some exceptional case where you got maybe some malevolent monarch or something on the throne. Okay, let me just give you some other examples here. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. What's that proverb teaching? Children have folly, have foolishness in them. Okay? So how do you get it out of them? Helen said, you spank them. Just let the fur fly, right? That's what she said. The rod of discipline is going to remove it far from them. Well, now, is that proverb, though, trying to say that in every single solitary case, you know, as long as you spank that child, and that child's going to turn out to just, you know, no longer do anything foolish? And no, that's not the point of the proverb, is it? It's not trying to make some absolute statement about what is always going to be true in every circumstance. And a lot of times the problem that I've seen people have with these proverbs is they treat them, every proverb, as if it's some absolute statement intended to express what will always be true in every circumstance. Let me give you another example. Proverbs 26, verse 4 says this: do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. Okay? So there are some people who are just foolish, and if you try to respond to them, then you're going to come off as a fool too. So sometimes it's better just to, that guy's a foolish person, don't even bother responding to him. Is that an absolute statement about what you should always do in every single case? Well, if you think it is, then keep reading, because the very next verse says this: answer a fool according to his folly, that he not be wise in his own eyes. Well, well, what's the truth of the matter? Do I answer the fool or do I not answer the fool? It depends on the fool. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on, you know, I need to ask him first. Which kind of fool are you?
I don't know.
Now, that probably wouldn't always work. No, but does everyone just see my point? In no way am I trying to undermine the truthfulness of what these proverbs are teaching. But if you interpret them to be teaching something that is absolutely the case in every circumstance, then you're just missing it. When you talk to your children about certain things that they need to do and you give them wise counsel, you know, have your kids ever come back, you know, and use your words against you? You know, Dad, you told me one time that you should, you know, and then, well, but that's not what I meant in that case, you know. And see, kids are trying to take your words that were just general truisms as if there were some absolute statement in every, and you weren't thinking of that scenario. That wasn't your context. That's not what your little word of wisdom was assuming. And so this is something that we need to understand. These proverbs, most of these proverbs, are not expressing absolute truism. But they're expressing what is generally true in ordinary circumstances. Okay? All things being equal, here's what would generally be true. But they're not necessarily expressing something that would have no exception possible. Now, you know, there are some proverbs that I guess you would treat as an absolute statement about, you know, say proverbs that talk about not sinning before God, or, you know, something like that. You know, it's never okay to sin against God. But there are some proverbs like that. But generally speaking, what these proverbs are truisms. they're the same kind of things that you say to your children where you're giving them a little bit of advice. And they're generally true. And a person, if he's wise, is going to appreciate that. For instance, Proverbs 22, verse 6. This proverb has probably caused more anxiety to more parents than any other proverb. And I think a lot of the times the problem is that people are treating this proverb as if it is an absolute statement, as if that's how it was intended. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, does that mean that if you train up your child in the ways of God, that without exception, that child will grow to be a fine Christian and will never fall away? Or is the reverse true that, well, if you have a child that falls away, then that necessarily means you didn't train him up the way you should have? I mean, is that how we should treat that proverb? That it's an absolute statement about what will always be true in every circumstance? I don't think so. But is it stating a general truism that if you train up your child to walk in the proper path, that generally speaking, that child's going to follow that path? But of course, this proverb was never intended to somehow deny human free will. You know, I mean, every child has their own free will, and they may be brought up by the best of parents and learn God's truth as well as any human parent could possibly teach them, but then they choose to go the other direction because they're a free will agent. That doesn't mean that proverb's wrong. And it doesn't mean that necessarily you were a terrible parent. But that's a general truism. And I've been in Bible class where people have wrestled with that, and they've tried to, well, maybe it doesn't mean this or that. It's just like so many of the proverbs, it's a general truism. Does that make any sense? I think it's important for us to realize this as we go throughout the book of Proverbs. Remember, part of wisdom is learning how to use these proverbs properly. They express truisms, that is what is generally true. And the truth of the proverb depends upon the right time and the right circumstances. The proper time and circumstance that the sage has in mind when he utters that proverb. Let me give you an example. Proverbs 23, verse 13 says this: do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with a rod, he will not die. You shall strike him with a rod and rescue his soul from Sheol. Now, I'm going to make the assertion that if you treat that proverb as an absolute statement of truth and you apply it in a mechanical fashion with every child at any time, in every circumstance, my assertion to you is that you're not being very wise. Because, all right, I've known of some young parents where they had a child who was a year old, too young to even understand anything, and yet they're just spanking that child and beating that child hard. And they've used this proverb to explain that because they're not going to be those kind of parents that don't discipline. Well, it says don't withhold discipline. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with a rod, he will not die. Well, I'm going to tell you what. You sure could cause a child to die if you strike him too hard with a rod. So, I mean, it's not intended to be an absolute statement, is it? And what's the kind of circumstance that proverb was intended to relate to? You as a parent with a little one-year-old baby, you think that's the kind of circumstance and the time that the sage had in mind? I don't think so. And I think we're not being wise if we do think so. But it's talking about the time and circumstance where you've got a child who's old enough to receive that rod, who's being rebellious, and if you refrain from disciplining that child and don't rein him in, then that child's not going to turn out the way that he should. And you're going to be somewhat responsible because you didn't discipline that child. And so quit worrying about being too hard on him, this proverb is saying, but you discipline that child. So there's a right time and circumstance, a right situation that proverb is relating to. And if you don't interpret it with that issue or that question in mind, what kind of circumstance is it talking about? If you don't ask that question, then you're not going to be wise. And I would suggest, if you're not careful, you're even going to be like this proverb warns. This proverb says, like a thorn bush brandished by the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. I want you to think about that. What is this proverb saying? What's the imagery that it's calling to mind, first of all? You got a drunkard, and what's he brandishing? What's he waving about and chasing everybody with? A thorn bush, okay? And the guy's drunk. Well, what likely is going to happen if you got a thorn bush with those thorns that can hurt people and you got a drunk that's got it in his hand? Going to hurt somebody with it. Or himself. Well, that is likened to, or maybe I should say it the other way around, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is likened to that. To this drunk guy who doesn't have any sense, and yet he's waving this thorn bush around. A proverb in the mouth of a fool. If you got a foolish person, can he take a proverb and misuse it and misapply it to really do harm to other people or to himself? Well, sure. Have you ever known somebody to do that, say, with the Word of God, maybe in other places of Scripture? Maybe take some statement of Scripture out of its intended context, out of the circumstance that it was addressing, and apply it in some way that the original author had no intention of, and yet someone then has now wrested the Scriptures and twisted its meaning to his own hurt or to the hurt of other people. Have you ever known people to do that? Well, sure, and they can do it with Proverbs too. So what we need to be careful of, we've been looking at this wisdom literature now for several class sessions. Well, we're getting our feet wet with it. But what we need to be careful of is to not take Proverbs, take a little bit of wisdom here, and use it foolishly. Because sometimes people can do that. And they can justify wrong action and totally foolish action with Proverbs. Because they can take a proverb out of its intended time and circumstance and apply it maybe in some mechanical way or in some way to justify their particular instance, but it's not what wisdom would say that proverb had in mind. And the right circumstance of time that it was speaking of. And so we need to be very, very careful about this. And this is why I say, and why at the beginning of this class, I said part of wisdom and part of the book of Proverbs is to teach us to understand a proverb and to figure the words of the wise and their riddles. So part of getting this wise counsel is to understand these proverbs properly. Understand what their intention is. Okay, that's part of wisdom too. Okay, Dave.
And there's two separate functions here in this particular passage. To know wisdom and instruction, discern the sayings, receive instruction, and all that. And for the purpose of giving prudence to the naive, you can use that wise knowledge that you gain to assist others, to help others to understand, learn.
Right. Exactly right. Comments about any of this that we've been talking about so far this evening? Yeah, Tom?
Just
Now, there's two authorities. I want to hear what their debating points are.
About Jesus.
About Jesus? Marilyn Denzel.
Well, Al Gore quotes it, John Kerry quotes it. These people are, you know, they have no business quoting it. They know nothing about it. But Meryl Streep and Bradley debating.
But they're actors.
They are.
They're outstanding actors. So they must be authorities on everything because they play those people in the movies.
That's right.
That makes me think about 2 months ago, and I may have mentioned this in a sermon, I was just kind of flipping through the channels, you know, men channels, sir, if I know that's hard to believe. And here was a documentary where Peter Jennings was being interviewed. Now, excuse me. It was the Larry King show. Peter Jennings was being interviewed by Larry King. The whole thing was on Peter Jennings, and the topic was the historical Jesus. Now, why in the world are they interviewing Peter Jennings? Because Peter Jennings was the narrator, the reporter who narrated a recent documentary where all of these so-called scholars were interviewed. Of course, those so-called scholars don't even believe the Bible, but of course, nobody ever mentioned that in the documentary. But they weren't interviewing the scholars. They were interviewing Peter Jennings because Peter Jennings had interviewed these scholars and had narrated the documentary. So, obviously, he's an expert on all the questions about Jesus and him historically and all this. You know, my mouth was just hanging open. I just thought, you have got to be kidding me. I'm not saying anything about Peter Jennings, you know, as a person or anything, or as a reporter or whatever. But, I mean, you've just got to be kidding me. But that's just exactly, you know, what this is talking about. You know, just because somebody is citing scripture, and old Peter quoted a bunch of scriptures, you know, from the Gospels, you know, and he just was so clueless about so much of what he was talking about. But anyway, but I'm sure Merrill and Denzel were a lot better. Other comments about this. Does everyone see why I'm emphasizing this point? I promise you, I have just seen so many occasions where people have just taken Proverbs and just pressed them to apply to just some circumstance that just, and then they just cause problems for themselves and other people. We just need to make sure we're recognizing the kind of literature that this is. Okay? Comments, questions about that? Okay. Well, let's look now at some other things here. We have been kind of using the first nine chapters, the father's discourse to his son, as sort of a springboard to look at various themes that are discussed in the book of Proverbs, various topics. And you will recall from your reading that the father in chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, talks about this particular subject, don't become a surety for a debt. You might be turning over there. I want to look at that passage in some detail in just a second. But I want us to talk about what surety for a debt is. And it's a concept that is talked about in several of the individual Proverbs. For instance, I'll just give you a couple here as you're turning over there to Proverbs 6. Proverbs 17, verse 18 says, a man lacking in sense pledges and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. And then Proverbs 11, verse 15 says, he who puts up security for another will surely suffer, but whoever refuses to strike hands in pledge is safe. That expression there at the end, whoever refuses to strike hands and pledge is safe. When would two people strike hands? That's maybe not the way we would say it. Shake hands. When you shake hands to confirm an agreement with the other person. So that's what it's talking about. But the overall point of these Proverbs is being a security or being a guarantor for another person's debt, or pledging in regard to the other person's debt, or as we're going to see in just a second in chapter 6, the expression is used to become a surety for another person's debt. What scenario is that talking about? To be a surety for somebody else's debt. Eddie? Yeah, we have this in our society. We maybe don't always use the term surety, but that's generally what you see used throughout the Bible. But the whole point of that, when you become a surety for another person's debt or a guarantor for another person's debt, well, let me just start with ancient Israel. You know, here's a person that is seeking a loan from you. And of course, you had wealthy people in ancient Israel who would, and other people would come to them for loans, okay? And you had some kind of, something similar to what we would think of as a bank or that kind of thing. And so you could seek a loan from somebody or maybe some people who had some amount of wealth. But, of course, they're going to want to make sure that you're good for that debt. And so they may not want to give you that loan. But if there's somebody that you can get to be a surety for your debt, what that means is if this person defaults on that loan, well, then they can go seek that debt from the person who became a surety for the debt. So it's like co-signing for a loan. Or I recently was told by some people that to get your electricity turned on, you have to have somebody who will co-sign for you. I guess it's your first month's electric bill or something, or the deposit or something. So the whole point of that is if you default on that, they want to be able to have somebody else they can go to collect their money. So that's the way it was in ancient Israel. And there are numerous proverbs that warn about this, that are saying, don't do this. And a lot of them are making points about someone is your neighbor and he seeks you to be the surety or the guarantor for his debt. And after all, we're neighbors. Now come on, won't you help me out? Because I won't get this loan if you're not a surety for it, you know. But what's the person always say? In fact, what would you think a person would say if he's trying to convince you to become a surety for his debt? Don't worry about it. I'm good for it. I'll take care of it. It's just a formality. But and so you're convinced by that. And remember who the book of Proverbs is chiefly directed to. Who is it? Young men, okay, who tend to be naive and stupid, you know. And, well, they do. And you know, you don't have to be young, but you know, that's who the book is written to. So here's a young guy and his friend, or, you know, oh, won't you be a buddy? And so many of these proverbs are saying a man lacking in sense pledges. You're stupid. You don't have any sense. If you put yourself in that position and you become a guarantor in the presence of your neighbor, whoever refuses to strike hands in pledges safe. So when somebody wants you, come on, shake my hand and agree to do this. And come with me to the creditor, and you know, you refuse to do that, you're somebody who is safe. You're somebody who's not going to suffer. Well, look at now Proverbs 6. And this is the kind of teaching that you see in the wisdom literature about being a debtor and putting yourself at financial risk. Now, there's some modern day applications to all of this that I want us to talk about in just a second. But right now, let's just make sure we see what the wise sage was saying to those in ancient Israel. Look at Proverbs 6, verses 1 through 5. My son, if you have become a surety for your neighbor, meaning you've already agreed to it, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself, since you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go, humble yourself, and importune your neighbor. Do not give sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. So what's the dad trying to say to his boy? If you become a surety for somebody's debt, what should the boy do? Go and plead to be released from that agreement. Yeah, you sure can, but please allow them to remove you from this. And the father says you need to do it like next month or by the end of the week. What's the father tell his boy? Don't let your eyelids, how's he word it? Don't give sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Before the end of today, remove yourself, if at all possible, from that position of being a surety for somebody else's debt, because you are in such grave risk. Now, I want to ask you a question. Why is it so risky? This is what a young man would ask. What's the big deal, Dad? I mean, Yehoseph, next door, we've been buddies for years, and he came to me, and he's getting married, and he just he got a little Jezebel, no, I guess not Jezebel, but whatever his wife's name is, you know, Ethel, that's a good Jewish name. You know, he just needs to have a little extra money to fix up the cottage for her and all that, and they won't give him a loan, but it's Yehoseph. He's just a great guy. What's wrong with it, Dad? What's wrong with it? Why is it so risky? Who has nothing to lose? Okay, well, if he defaults, then the ultimate guy who's responsible is you. Okay? But he's not going to default. I mean, Yehoseph is a good, hard-working guy. He's honest. So why is it a risk?
It seems to be a debt, not to cover, first of all, without some serious consequences. The consequences for them weren't just that they were repossessed of an automobile. The consequences for them, they were sold into slavery because of the debt. And I think that you understand that the impact is you can greatly alter impact.
Absolutely right. But Yehoseph is an honest guy. He's going to pay it. So it's just a formality. You really won't be at risk. What's wrong with that logic? What is the assumption? Or what are the assumptions in all of that? That Yehoseph is going to continue to be able to work. What happens if the millstone runs over his foot and he crushes his foot and now he can't work? And now he comes to you and says, I had every intention of paying this debt, but I'm lame now. Well, guess what? You're responsible then. You're exactly right. Yehoseph really wasn't at risk. You are, and ultimately the risk is paramount. In other words, there are things that you don't know about the future. And the guy that wants you to be surety for his debt, he doesn't know about the future. And so you are at great risk by just sort of just assuming that all things are going to stay the same and all things are going to be fine. What's another possibility with Jehoshaphat? Even though you grew up together and he's just always been a great guy, what's another possibility? He may really turn out to be a scoundrel and just renege. Well, if he does, guess what? You're the one whom they're coming after. You know, he's a free will agent. He may be a fool. He may be a dishonest person. You know, there are all sorts of things that can happen. And the real reason why I think it's so crucial for us to talk about this, and in fact, this is one of the things that I talk about when I'm counseling with young married couples, because young people in our society today, I mean, maybe you don't have all these occasions to be a surety for somebody else's debt or to co-sign for somebody else's car loan. That may not, I mean, I guess you could have some case like that. But look at what is the basis for all of this teaching. The basis for all of this teaching is being in debt and owing money to somebody else is not a good thing. I mean, that's a risky thing. I mean, it isn't something to just kind of, you know, just treat lightly. And, you know, here's a case where you're saying, I'm going to be responsible for this debt over here. It's somebody else's debt. The wisdom teaching is saying you sure don't want to be responsible for that. It's bad enough if you have to be in debt yourself for your own obligations. You sure don't want to do it in regard to another person. What I want us to get from all this is that being in debt and owing other people is not a good thing, for the very same reasons that being a surety for somebody else's debt is not a good thing. Why is this such an important thing for our young people today? Everybody who is 25 and younger here, okay, 25 and younger, raise your hand if you either have right now a credit card or you have received in the mail that you've been pre-approved for this Visa card or MasterCard or whatever with this credit limit. Raise your hand, 25 and younger, if you already have a credit card or if you could have one because you were pre-approved. Raise them high. I want everybody to see. Raise them. Okay. Look at all these young people here. And they are sent all this stuff to make them instant debtors. And why is that so attractive?
They can have what they want now.
Have it right now. You don't have to wait. And why do all those creditors send all those pre-approved credit cards to all the freshmen in college? And all those young people that age, why don't they send them to all these 65-year-olds? They may send some, but why do they especially target that age group? Because they're inexperienced, they're on their own, or as Proverbs says, they're just foolish. They don't. It's not a slap at them, but they are. They don't. That's what being inexperienced means. And so they're just a sitting duck for that kind of thing. I don't know how many couples I have talked with in premarriage counseling, and like a lot of them, like they couples get married a lot later now, just on average, you know. Like, you know, 25, 27, 30, you know. And I've talked with couples where they've been single and away from their parents' home that many years. You know, 5 years, 10 years maybe. And they have all that time, you know, to be saving up a nice nest egg, you know, so when they do get married, you know, then hey, you're going to be able to start out and just be in great shape, you know, down payment on a house, say, or whatever, you know. And yet, I can't tell you how many times I've talked with couples, they have credit card debt while they're single. Like maybe they both have like $5,000 on their credit cards, and then they get married, and now what? Well, they got $10,000 credit. Now they're both responsible for it, and you know, and so they start out with all that in the hole. I mean, why is that a bad thing? I mean, because young people think, you know, well, but we can pay the minimum payment. And I've got a good job. What's the assumption that they're making? It's always going to stay the same. What happens if you have an accident and you can't work? You're still responsible for that debt. Or I've seen this so many times. The couple, they're married and they're both working and they've both got good jobs so they can afford the two brand new cars and the new TV and the stereo system and all that stuff. But then what happens? She gets pregnant. And now she can't work her job. And so now, you know what? I mean, married people, yeah, wives get pregnant, you know. I mean, that's not some, you know, you're kidding me. You pregnancy? I didn't know how that happened, you know. I mean, but it's like that they just look at the near future, just a myopic view of things. And listen, I'm saying this as someone who's been guilty of this. I'm not Captain Finance here. Certain people in this auditorium know that. You know, I'm not somebody who's, you know. But I'm saying this is what the wisdom literature is trying to get us to see. Being at risk financially to somebody else is not a good thing. Now, these proverbs are not saying, and I don't believe they're saying that it's a sin to co-sign for a loan or something. Again, this is not some absolute, it's always, but this is just general truths, especially for young people, especially in where they're young and naive, and you put yourself at risk, and the father was saying to his son, don't make that mistake, okay? Sure, sure. It's because God wants the very, very best for us. Dave? And he was able financially to assume the loan if you did default. He wasn't just, but the young man hadn't built up enough money to be able to do that. Yeah. And, you know, I've had people, you know, say, well, I mean, is this saying that it's a sin to have a mortgage on your home or something? Well, no. But again, I think what all these passages do teach is just some wisdom that, you know, being at risk financially, you know, it's just not a good thing. And you need to be very, 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 very cautious about this kind of thing.
It really boils down to speaking false.
You can't assume that risk.
It really doesn't matter how old you are.
Absolutely.
Whether you're a young man or an old man.
Absolutely.
If you do something that is false, then you're doing wrong. You're using more risk.
Right. Okay. Right. You see what we've been saying about how the Proverbs are talking about things that are very, very practical in everyday life? This is not a discourse on what heaven is going to be like, or even how to get to heaven. It's a discourse on how to make it through this earthly life wisely. Okay?